Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. I personally take Super Beets when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Super Beets gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at IntelligentBeets.com. That's IntelligentBeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about a great new book, A Doctor's Guide to Alternative Medicine, What Works, What Doesn't, and Why. We've invited the author, Dr. Mel Borens, to join us. Dr. Borens has been active for more than two decades in training physicians. That's important because in addition to treating patients, he also spends time with medical residents and doctors in practice, introducing them to complementary and alternative medicine with a focus on stress reduction, counseling, and psychotherapy, and communication skills, which is important. He has been a regular contributor to medical journals, and he's a speaker at medical conferences. He's also appeared on TV and radio across North America. He lives in Toronto, Canada. So welcome to Intelligent Medicine. By the way, you're the author of a couple of books. Go Away Just for the Health of It, An Apple a Day, a Holistic Health Primer, and Photos and Songs of a Pranoic Physician. I know that you're also a musical composer as well, right?
That's true. It's very nice to be with you today, Dr. Hoffman.
It's my pleasure. And actually, if you go to the website, Mel Borens, what is it, melborens.com or Dr. Borens?
No, actually, melborens.com is one website, and the Mel Borens Creative, melborenscreative.com, has some of those funny medical songs and the DVD of the inspiring video songs that with photographs and music. So the Mel Borens Creative, you'll get some of the chapters also from my new book.
And when is the Broadway play planned for?
You know, that's a whole other story. That's a whole other story.
Well, you have multiple. It seems like you have multiple incarnations, and that's great because, you know, as we'll get to in this podcast, one of the therapeutic tools of medicine is humor and laughter. But you know, it goes beyond that because, you know, you're not just someone that puts on a clown suit or sings funny songs. You actually have quite a lot of depth and knowledge in the field of complementary alternative medicine. And what I like about your book is it's balanced because, you know, you don't accept every premise in complementary and alternative medicine as being true, because there's stuff out there that's folkloric, there's stuff that's unproven, even bogus, and you're not afraid to call a spade in your book.
Well, that's true, Ron. I appreciate that, yes.
Indeed. Okay, so your rationale in writing the book, first of all, you wanted to be a little bit of an ambassador to your profession about a field that's often treated with a great deal of skepticism. Do you feel that you have to overcome a lot of resistance when you present the case for complementary alternative medicine?
Well, I do want to be an ambassador, you know, for the science of alternative medicine, because many people don't realize that there are randomly assigned double-blind controlled trials that show that some natural health products, some herbal remedies, acupuncture, chiropractic, massage therapy, some psychological approaches, there's some science to it. There's randomly assigned double-blind controlled trials comparing these approaches to placebo or to sham, and I wanted to be an ambassador around that, about teaching people, both the public and health professionals, that the science does exist.
What, did you often hear the litany, you know, from some of your colleagues, well, if it was so good, wouldn't it be approved as part of mainstream medicine, or wouldn't all the doctors be using it? Was this kind of a frequent meme in conventional medicine, right?
Well, you know, interestingly, the medical profession has started, you know, and historically have been a little bit slow on the upkeep, but beginning to adapt some of it. So we see acupuncture practiced in hospitals and pain clinics. I see infectious disease specialists and gastroenterologists prescribing probiotics I see doctors talking about vitamin D deficiency. Certainly there are ophthalmologists who prescribe vitamins and minerals and antioxidants for macular degeneration. So even though we're a conservative profession and we're kind of slow on the upkeep, I see that, generally things that would be considered, let's say, alternative 5 years ago are now really becoming part of mainstream medicine.
Well, indeed. And in your book, you talk about several of them. So let's go through some of the things that you consider in your book, A Doctor's Guide for Alternative Medicine. You talk about echinacea. Tell us about that.
Well, echinacea is controversial because there are studies that show that it doesn't work scientifically, and there are studies that show that it works, that it's helpful in preventing colds. And I think the problem is that there's, many species of echinacea. 9 different native species of an echinacea is known. And also some of the studies use the whole herb, some of them use the leaves, some of them use the root. And so it's hard to judge from some of the research, does echinacea work or not? I believe, from looking at the literature and looking at the scientific studies and from my own clinical practice and from my own personal experience, I believe echinacea is useful at the first sign of a cold. If you take it in a tincture and you take it every few hours, I believe that it shortens the severity and the length of the cold. So, there's always worries about taking echinacea if you have immune depression, like if you're on immune suppressive drugs or if you have a immune problem that echinacea might interfere with. But generally, I think it's a pretty safe drug, but maybe should be not taken with people who have, let's say, tuberculosis or HIV disease or lupus, because it really hasn't been properly studied in these conditions.
In other words, it could over-rev the immune system that, in fact, it might be desirable to keep modulated.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. One of your favorite herbs appears because you kind of lead off your book with a discussion of it, and this is actually one of the most popular herbs worldwide, more popular in Europe even than it is here, is St. John's wort for depression. What did your research lead you to discover about that?
Well, once again, I think there's very good scientific evidence that St. John's wort is effective in mild to moderate depression. Some of the headlines are St. John's wort doesn't work, and I think some of the studies with St. John's wort in severe depression show that maybe it isn't all that effective, and similarly our modern drugs aren't sometimes that effective in people with severe depression. I personally would prefer to use a modern drug, an SSRI, or some of the new modern antidepressant drugs, and combine it with psychotherapy. And I have a chapter on exercise for depression, so using other modalities as well. And depression, shouldn't be treated as a mild kind of condition. It's a very serious condition, and I still personally would prefer to use the modern drugs as the first line. Now, there's some people who really don't want to use modern drugs or have had bad experiences with it or have had relatives who've had bad experiences with some of our drugs that we use, and so they would feel more comfortable at using a herbal preparation. But it's important to know that the herbal preparation should be used at the right dosage for the right amount of time, and probably should be supervised. You should be supervised by a healthcare practitioner around using it to make sure that you use it regularly and not to stop it just because you're feeling better. Because mm-hmm. there's a tendency, once you feel better, to stop the herb, and then the incidence of relapse, I think, is high. So like a modern medical antidepressant, I recommend using it for 9 months to a year before stopping it or cutting back, and it should be used at the proper dose of 300 milligrams 3 times a day. And sometimes it takes a few weeks before you'll notice an improvement. I think the important thing is the worry that it can interfere or interact with some of our modern drugs. so that the worry is that people who are on Digoxin, people who are on Indivir for HIV disease, people who are on cyclosporin for heart transplant issues, people who are on warfarin, people who are even on statin drugs, there is an anti-epileptic drugs, there is an interaction with St. John's wort and in the breakdown of these medications. So what's happened is that if you take combining St. John's wort with these medications, it can interfere with the activity of these medications, and there's been reports in the literature of people where their epilepsy seizures return, or they heart transplant rejection, or their HIV disease gets worse. So I think that's a caution with everything we do. There's always a potential risk or danger. There's a potential interaction with modern medicine. And, you know, I still recommend, you know, seeking care from your medical doctor or other health care practitioner.
Well, indeed. You know, I think it's important, particularly when people are taking medications, that they coordinate it. All too often, there's a lack of communication. And I think that's because doctors, actually patients, are reluctant sometimes to share with doctors because they feel that they'll be subject to a storm of skepticism or even abuse if they say, well, I'm using this or I'm using that. So they kind of keep it on the QT. And then we can have these potential interactions.
Well, that's right. And as you said, you know, at the beginning, there's quite so much information out there, and we as physicians have seen people who are taking things that really are not helpful, not useful. We've seen people who've been harmed sometimes by so-called natural products, and doctors tend to be a conservative group. We tend to, you know, want to talk about things that we've been trained in medical school or in, you know, our conferences to talk about. And so, yeah, sometimes patients might be, might get skepticism. I tell them, you know, buy my book, give it as a gift to your physician, because at least it'll educate them about the science behind some of the things that you're doing. And you know, then once the physician sees that there's some randomly assigned double-blind controlled trials, they might be much more comfortable with you taking an alternative approach.
Moving around, another popular herb that you evaluated in your book is horse chestnut. Again, popular in Europe, less recognized here for vein problems and leg swelling. What's the evidence on that?
Well, there is some evidence that taking horse chestnut seed extract improves pain and swelling, leg pain and swelling, in those who take it compared to placebo. And you're quite right, it's much more commonly used in Europe. I personally don't have that much experience with it, and I was so surprised to see the research being so compelling for venous insufficiency, or, you know, varicose veins and swelling of the legs and pain in the legs from this problem. But I had to include it because the research is pretty significant, showing that it helps with swelling and pain in people who are suffering from this condition.
Another one of the herbs that you consider in your book is ginkgo biloba. Something that's often used for cognitive enhancement, circulatory problems. What does the evidence show there, and are there potential problems with it?
Well, you know, ginkgo is kind of a mixed bag in that there are some good studies that show it doesn't work at all, and there are a couple of studies that show that, you know, taking ginkgo does improve cognitive functioning. There's some also studies that show it's helpful for people who get leg pain from walking if they have peripheral vascular disease, not enough circulation to their legs. So there is the evidence. I think the biggest worry about ginkgo for me is taking it along with aspirin or a blood thinner like Coumadin, because there have been reports of in the literature of people having hemorrhages in the brain, like strokes, even bleeding in the eye, or problem with bleeding elsewhere if they take ginkgo and an aspirin or Coumadin or a blood thinner. So that's my biggest concern around ginkgo, that people may not know this, and the literature does have cases of people running into trouble taking it.
Doesn't it strike you, though, that sometimes in the literature there's an episode of some sort of bad outcome that occurs when a person's taking a powerful conventional medication along with a natural product, and then the implication is that you shouldn't be taking the natural product when we know that there's literally millions and millions of adverse reactions that occur just with conventional medications alone. Bleeding occurs with aspirin very frequently, and, you know, Coumadin, of course, can be catastrophic if it, taken in excess. And so, but then they'll say, well, you know, it was the ginkgo biloba that did it, or, you know, which may or may not be the case and needs to be looked at with an open mind.
Of course, yeah, of course. Generally, people are taking Coumadin for, you know, some very serious problems, and that's why I'm saying if I had the choice of which to stop, I would tend to, you know, stop the herbal product and not the Coumadin so much. That's my comment. Sometimes people are taking, you know, aspirin just because they're decided it's a good thing. There's no evidence or scientific support for the taking of the aspirin as a prevention, and therefore, yeah, you're right. I just think that the worry is sometimes people think of herbs as entirely innocuous and not a problem, and we do know that there are reports of people buying herbal products outside of North America from, let's say, Hong Kong, or on mail order, or bringing a herb back from India or China, and sometimes that herb can be added extra things to that herb that shouldn't be there, like drugs or
a little bit of Viagra, maybe some prednisone, powerful non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and you feel better or you get a result, but it's because it's spiked.
That's right. So we have to warn people to be cautious about where they're purchasing. I wouldn't recommend bringing stuff back from China or India or buying off the internet. It's kind of a buyer beware. So I just wanted to add that, there's always a concern of toxic substances in the herbal product. And some cultures actually use lead or mercury in their traditional formulations. Mm-hmm. And there have been reports of people having problems with this.
Yeah, there's reports from my alma mater, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where people actually use mercury in rituals in their, as part of like a Caribbean religion ward off evil spirits or, something, ghosts, and they spread it around their apartments and can have toxicity from mercury. So they're, weird stuff.
Exactly. I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, thank you for that.
So you also focus in on a few specific conditions. One of the conditions that you want to point out that there's nutritional support for is a very common condition. It's actually the leading cause of liver failure and the need for liver transplant in America, surprisingly, is not hepatitis. It's not alcoholism. It's our diets, and we get a condition called fatty liver. So you actually share with doctors and readers about evidence that a common nutrient may be helpful there.
That's right. It's called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is pretty serious in North America, because the fat that we have gets deposited both in our bellies and around our bellies, but it also gets deposited in the liver, and there's the risk that fatty liver deposits can lead to cirrhosis and liver damage. There is controversy about the use of vitamin E. There's trials that show that vitamin E is useful for slowing down non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and there's some trials that show that it is good and it's beneficial. I think some of the that using vitamin E preventatively could slow down the fatty liver disease. Obviously, the first thing is to lose weight, because when you lose weight, the fat improves, the deposits improve, and that's the real preventative way to do it. Losing weight is number one. There's also the concern about vitamin E, because there, you know, it's been raised that vitamin E isn't safe anymore and that it can cause other problems. And some of the people who are knowledgeable in this area believe that it's to do with the synthetic form of vitamin D, the DL form, as opposed to the, let's say, the gamma-tociferol, the natural form. And some people believe that the synthetic form is the one that hasn't been all that useful and can be sometimes linked to maybe causing problems. So I'm suggesting that if you're going to use vitamin E for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, that it's important to choose a natural form of vitamin E like gamma-tociferol and not the DL gamma or the DL alpha, which some people believe might be harmful.
Right. We want to mimic nature as much as we can, and sometimes it turns out that it's not nice to fool with Mother Nature. We try to extract some very narrow fraction or synthesize a copycat. It doesn't really work out well.
That's right. Yes. That's right.
One of the areas of great success in the field of nutritional support for medical conditions that you highlight in the book is in treatment of eye diseases. So talk to us about that.
Well, there's a condition called age-related macular degeneration. It's one of the more common causes nowadays of people going blind. And I think the medical profession, this is one of the situations where the medical profession has actually looked at the research, believes in the research, and I find that many ophthalmologists are recommending using a combination of vitamins and antioxidants to slow down the progression of dry form, the age-related macular degeneration. And it's a formulation with vitamin C and vitamin E and some beta-carotene and some zinc and some copper and sometimes some added antioxidants. And that formula has now been, you know, I see my ophthalmology colleagues prescribing it for slowing down the dry form of macular degeneration. And this is where, you know, let's say 5 years ago, it might have not been that common, but now it's kind of an accepted approach, and using the vitamins and the minerals, you know, is more accepted by our medical colleagues as a reasonable thing to do to prevent the progression.
Well, this is actually one of the instances where natural medicine trumps conventional medicine, because so far they haven't come up with good treatments for dry macular degeneration. The wet macular degeneration, they've got various types of injections and growth factors that they can inject directly in the eyeball, and that seems to slow it. But when it comes to dry, the whole ball game seems to be about nutritional support. That's where the evidence-based medicine points to.
That's right, Dr. Hoffman. You're perfectly right about that.
Indeed. All right, so this is a logical point at which to pause, because today we're talking about a doctor's guide to alternative medicine, what works, what doesn't work, and why. It's a rational, evidence-based look at the world of complementary and alternative medicine by an MD, our guest today, Dr. Mel Borins. And when we return, we're going to talk about some other aspects of alternative medicine, because alternative medicine isn't just about vitamins and supplements and herbs. It's a wide-ranging array of approaches. And we're going to open our lenses a little wider in part two to talk about acupuncture and to talk about therapies that deal with stress, which is a very, very important component of many diseases, according to today's guest, Dr. Mel Borins. The website, once again, is melborins.com, correct?
That's right, or melborinscreative.com, melborinscreative.com.
And I urge you very heartily to visit it, because there are some really funny satirical songs there that you can listen to and enjoy. All right, when we return, part two of today's podcast with Dr. Mel Borins. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.